Yesterday I told some stories. Today I'll tell you my least favourite Buddhist story. The one that should be excised. And this is the story in which the two monks are going on Tudong and they reach a river and there's this young woman and she's all alone and she needs to cross the river and it's getting dark and it's dangerous. And one monk is very strict in the Vinaya and he won't have anything to do with her. And then the other monk, he lifts the woman up and carries her across the river like a hero, puts her down, saves her life. And the other monk is very upset because he's broken his precepts. And they're walking along and he won't talk to his friend. And his friend says, "What's wrong with you?" And he says, "How could you do that? How could you carry that woman across the water?" And the other monk says, "You've carried her longer than I did. I just carried her across the river. You're still carrying her now after all this time. You can't let go of what happened." So this is a story which has been reproduced in many books and Dhamma talks, and it's a crap story. And what's the reason why is it a bad story? Because being Tudong monks ourselves, and we put ourselves in that position, it's not a black and white situation in which A, you keep your precepts and you're sort of this kind of mean Hinayana, purity obsessed fanatic who lets a young woman fall into a river or get raped and murdered because your precepts are more important, which is the kind of idea you get from this story. But what happens is Ajahn Kevali and me, we're on Tudong, and there's this young lady and she's by the side of the river and says, help me, I'm lost and it's dark. We say, "Well, where are you going?" "I've got to cross the river." And I say, "Well, look, you know, there's no bridge here right now. The water looks a bit dangerous. We'll walk with you. There's a village back there a couple of kilometers and we'll get some assistance for you. Or there's a bridge and we'll take you to the bridge. Just follow along behind us." I mean, there's 101 ways of helping someone without breaking your precepts. But this idea is, you know, keeping your precepts means you just sort of, you know, become narrow and selfish and obsessed with rules and rituals. And it's not true. And the rules are what give you the framework, you know, or the... who was it? Robert Frost, the American poet. And he didn't like blank verse. He always said, used to write a structured verse. And he said, writing blank verse is like playing tennis without a net. Okay? So we can say, like, developing mindfulness, leading holy life without the precepts is like playing tennis without a net. You have to have certain boundaries and certain conventions, and then you're creative within them. And you see over and over again, the most creative people tend to be the ones that have certain rules circumscribing their conduct. When I used to go back to England, it's not really the case anymore, but Britain used to have the best adverts, I think, anywhere. And I remember particularly one year going back and going through the middle of London, and there was this huge billboard, and there was no writing on it at all, which in those days was really unusual, and it was this beautiful sort of billowing gossamer-like silk, and then just in one corner there was a kind of a slash, very artistic slash in the silk. You know, and it's just so beautiful, like a work of art. You know, and you, "Hey, that must be an advert for something. What is it? Silk slash? Oh, silk cut cigarettes. You see. Do you know there's a brand of cigarettes called Silk Cut? You see, I don't know who they're called. But because the laws have become so strict about what you can say about cigarettes, you can hardly say anything. You can't say it makes you happier, it makes you more healthy, it makes you more cool. You couldn't say any of these things. So it really forced them to be creative. And it was the same with the alcohol adverts. You know, so I found as a monk, you know, I was looking at the alcohol and the cigarette adverts because it's really they were the best ones. The point being that the restrictions of the vinaya, you know, are not something which imprison you or any way lead to a reduction in the quality of your life, but they're the conditions for it. And vinaya is to be approached with wisdom. The particular, I was giving it on, talking to the lay people about this the other day. You know, if we look at morality, the idea of what is morality, look at its meaning in different religions and religious systems, then the monotheistic religions, the ones that grew up in, the ones we know, the ones who grew up in the Middle East, they have this idea of there's someone up there who created the world and created everything, and he tells you what to do. And if you're wise, you'll do what he tells you because you'll get a reward, and if you don't, you'll get a very nasty punishment. So it's got a reward and punishment system. Now, if you look at the individual precepts or rules or commandments, you can see some overlap with the Buddhist. So some people who want, you know, to join everything up and say, well, it's all one and the same thing, morality is morality. But it's not. I mean, you can build a jetty and a slaughterhouse out of bricks, you know, and you say, well, nobody, suppose you didn't really know what a slaughterhouse was and what a jetty was, and somebody says, well, really, they're more or less the same thing. Look, they're made of these things called bricks. You know, it's a faulty argument. So the essential point in, or the unique feature of sila, whether it's lay sila or monastic sila, absolute fundamental point, it has to be voluntary. If for some reason you refrain from hurting someone or taking advantage of someone because you're afraid of getting caught or afraid that people will lose their respect for you or will feel contempt for you, or you're afraid of going to prison, or even if you're afraid of going to hell, then that would have a certain social value for sure. And this is how Islamic countries often run. But it's not sila. It's not sila in the Buddhist sense, because it's not integrated into this organic training of sila, samadhi, and vanya. Your sila is a sila when it provides a foundation for samadhi. And if you're simply not doing certain things or not saying certain things because of fear, it's not going to have the psychological effect which is intrinsic to the threefold training. So the wisdom and understanding the value of precepts and having the wisdom to be able to use them well is the point. So sikkhapada, the word sikkhapada in itself, points to this. So sikkha means training or education. Pada means like a point. So it's when lay people take the five precepts or the eight precepts, they're saying, I undertake the training of conduct, of my conduct, through not killing, not stealing. So it's a training, it's an education of how you act and how you speak, rather than conforming to laws and commandments which are backed up with great force and deterrence of various kinds. So we've had people come in, oh, you're so strict in the vinaya, you're attached. Now, that's not a very fair statement. If somebody says you're attached to the vineyard, so what can you do to disprove that? You're like, okay, I'll break a few precepts to show you I'm not. You know, is that how you prove you're not attached? But the distinction you need to make is the distinction between attachment on one side and devotion and commitment to the others. We could say, okay, you're attached to your husband or your wife, you know, and you should prove you're not attached by having an affair. Is that the way you prove you're not attached in the wrong way? Well, you would never suggest that to somebody. But the fact that we keep our precepts and we have a devotion and commitment to precepts for all of our monastic life is not in itself an indication of an unhealthy attachment. It's not to say that attachment can't arise. And one of the things to watch out for, a sign of an unhealthy relationship to vinaya or an unhealthy relationship to sila, is that sense you feel superior to people who don't keep precepts. And this defilement is emphasized by the Buddha again and again and again. He says, if you keep all the precepts well, you're completely impeccable in your conduct, but on the basis of that impeccable conduct, you believe yourself to be superior to someone who doesn't keep the precepts well, then that's an attachment. So, you know, if you start feeling as a forest monk, forest monks can get very arrogant sometimes. You know, you see the Wat Pahn monks coming and they look kind of, you know, loose and sleazy and they're all over there, maybe they're smoking a cigarette, you know. So if you think you're better than they are because they don't wear their robe properly or they smoke cigarettes or they handle money or they do all these other kinds of things, then by that token, your sila becomes impure. Your sila is undermined by that kind of arrogance. So for this reason, you can see sila is not sort of this straightforward kind of, you know, keep a precept or you don't keep a precept, but it has to be keeping a precept with wisdom, free of cravings for, some people keep precepts for because people want to be respected and looked up to. And One of the best reads in the commentaries, one of the most enjoyable. I used to read this out sometimes. It's in the Visuddhimagga, which is a thick tome, not well known for its page turning qualities. But if you read the section on wrong livelihood for monks, it's really good, and you have all these sneaky monks doing these. It's like you're walking along the road, a layperson's walking along the road, let's say they're eating this, not exact memory, eating this like corn cob, you know, and it's that's it. And the monk walks by, and the monk says, "Layman, that corn cob must have a really bad taste. That must be a really unenjoyable corn cob." And he says, "Venerable sir, why do you say that?" He says, "Well, you are such a faithful lay person. You've got so much satar in the sangha and the Buddha sasana. If those corn cobs were really delicious, you would have offered me one by now." And he said, "So this is the way all these like sneaky monks used to do things, or monks would, you know, never change their jiwan and patch it and patch it and patch it, because there are always people who think that monks who patch their robes are more virtuous than monks that get a new one." And yeah, so patching robes wrong? No, patching robes is very good and to be recommended. But you've probably seen some monks, it becomes a fetish. There was one monk, I mean, he looks so cool. Do anybody know Jethro Tull? Do you? Like, yeah, you know, like Ian Anderson. You know, he looked like, you know, in this robe, and it was all this like tawny and brown and yellow and covered, and you just walk along like this, you know, like a rock star. And you go into these big gowns of Wat Pa Kong, and everybody's, oh, so ging, you know. So sometimes, you know, even the sort of good qualities that can be taken on and made something out of. So you obviously need wisdom and humility and sensitivity and so on. Okay, that's my overview.
Thank you very much.